The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
On Every Tide, Sean Connolly's new book charts the sweeping history of Irish emigration. It starts in the early 18th century, and the book shows how the Irish fled limited opportunity at home and fanned out across America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and became a world force in politics and religion. It's deeply researched. It's vividly told. It's essential reading for understanding how the people of Ireland shaped the world. It's also essential reading for giving a different lens on Irish emigration. Sean, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Can I start with that different lens? You talk about a theme called MOPE, M-O-P-E, the most oppressed people ever. That is the often assumed view that the Irish have of ourselves. And you say that particularly when it comes to emigration, that may not be true, that in many instances and for much of our emigration, it was economically driven rather than driven by poverty and subjugation.
Well, first of all, MOPE is the invention of my colleague here at Queen's University, Liam Kennedy, Most Oppressed People Ever. The challenge when you're writing about emigration is to strike a balance, because obviously there is a very dark side to the picture, particularly in the case of the famine, when people really are fleeing total economic collapse and the threat of death from starvation or fever.
Although you point out that emigration was endemic before that, and endemic as much for opportunity as for escape.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. It's a question of balance. You don't want to cover up the dark side, but you have to recognize that for a good 20 years before the famine, growing numbers of people were emigrating. And the society was not yet in the point of collapse, but opportunities were narrowing. There were fewer opportunities at home, and so people emigrated.
It's interesting in the book when you look at that early stage of emigration, the manner in which the journey was handled, because effectively, unless you were very wealthy, the emigrants were little more than ballast.
The whole thing is driven by the international economy. The reason the United States is going to let these people in is because they're desperate for cheap labor. And the reason they can get to the United States is that the goods crossing the Atlantic west to east are things like cotton and timber, which are bulky, and that means there's lots of empty space on the way back. If you don't have passengers, you just have to fill the ship up with sand or gravel as ballast. So yes, the ease with which the Irish can seek a better life elsewhere is created by a new international economy.
You're very interesting on the effect that it has in Ireland as well, because one of the things that you talk about is, you say that there is a sort of an assumption that the Irish tendency to give the farm and the land to the firstborn son disenfranchised the second, third and fourth, and they were therefore forced to emigration. But you take it the other way around, that emigration provided the outlet whereby we could culturally wed ourselves to that thing of the land being passed to the firstborn.
With the American historian Timothy Guinane who first suggested this, and seems to me to make a lot of sense. One small point, by the way, it wasn't always the firstborn son. In many cases, it was a younger son. And of course, that makes sense. If you're the firstborn son, you're going to have to hang around a lot longer before you inherit the farm, and you're possibly rather more strong-willed and less docile. So in many ways, you know, it's a self-selecting thing. It is the more biddable sons and daughters who stay, and the more adventurous and potentially discontented who go. You can sound the whole thing in his head and say it's not that these people are being driven out by a rigid social system, but the ease with which these people can find a new life, and in many ways a better life elsewhere, makes it possible to retain this very restrictive system of inheritance.
And you're also very interesting about it in the way that you talk about how we created a sort of a social delusion around the people who were going for reasons of opportunity rather than for reasons of penury. You talk about the American wake almost being an excuse for families.
There's a lot. I mean, the American wake is a famous institution. It mimics the wake you have over a dead person, where people gather and there's this final gathering before the person takes the train for a port and then the ship. A number of observers point out that the whole tone of the American wake is difficult to pin down. There is obviously a degree of sorrow. People are never going to see each other again. But there is also a certain amount of ritual that these people are choosing to make a life elsewhere they're going. And by treating the whole thing as a sort of tragedy that's befallen the family, you're glossing over the extent to which it's the dynamics of the family that is causing these people to leave. It's a sort of abdication of responsibility.
That by sitting around and mourning the departure, we can tell ourselves that it's a necessity rather than a choice.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And you have observers, when they question people from the shipping lines in the 1880s, what's the demeanour of the people getting on the boat at Queenstown? And they say very clearly, most of them seem to regard it as a great adventure. They are not getting on with sorrowful faces. They are looking forward to a new life.
You can almost hear people taking offence as you say something like that, Sean, because the opposite is so embedded in our thinking.
Well, as I say, I have tried to bring out the bleaker side of it as well. There is a great deal of mythology built up. The Catholic Church, for example, says that it disapproves of emigration, is worried about the faith and morals of the emigrants. So the convent schools are training girls in cookery and needlework, precisely the skills they're going to need as domestic servants on the other side of the Atlantic. And with another side, Catholic priests are talking up this great spiritual empire being created throughout the English-speaking world, that it's being conquered for the true church by Irish emigration. So yes, there is a lot of doublethink.
You mentioned that the convents training up the young women with the skills that might be useful if they decided to emigrate. That's one of the things that you also stand on its head. The experience of emigration is surprisingly more female than one might have thought. You talk about the pioneering role of young women in the early stages of emigration and the sort of the entrepreneurial desire to make it when they would get to either America or Australia.
And I have to admit, it is one of the things that I think we still need a lot more work to fully explain. But, the Irish stand out for the role of women as independent migrants. Most other people like Italians, Poles and so on, the great majority of the immigrants are males. And if women do go, they go as somebody's daughter or somebody's wife. The Irish stand out for close to half of the immigrants being young women travelling independently, not as somebody's daughter, somebody's wife, but as an independent migrant. And what exactly it is in Irish cultural change in the first half of the 19th century that makes that possible, nobody has ever quite explained yet. But we tend to think of Ireland as a very conservative, patriarchal society. But in this measure, Irish women show remarkable control of their own destinies.
The other area that you highlight where Ireland stands almost unique is in our emigrants' desire not to come back, even when they can.
That is again very noticeable, that high proportions, a quarter, a third of the Southern and Eastern Europeans who go to the United States, stay a few years, earn money, and then take the money back to establish themselves back in the homeland. The Irish don't. The number of Irish who return is very small. Now, again, you can interpret that in two ways. You can, of course, say, well, what was there to come back to? This is a society dominated by a small family farm. There's not a great deal of employment off the land. People left because of lack of opportunities. There isn't a great deal to come back for. But equally, you can say it's a measure of the extent to which they have managed to establish themselves in their new homes in the United States don't necessarily want to come back. The wife of a reasonably successful blue-collar worker in Boston would not probably take kindly to becoming, the wife on a 20-acre farm in County Tipperary with all the drudgery that went with that.
And the book then goes on to examine the political and religious implications of those emigrants staying in such large numbers and the influence that they had both in America, in Canada, in Australia, and to a lesser extent as well in New Zealand. It's the sort of definitive work in respect of Irish emigration. It's called On Every Tide, The Making and Remaking of the Irish World. And the author is Sean Connolly. Sean, thank you again.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.